DC.
I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. The U.S. State Department says Secretary of State Antony Blinken pressed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in talks on Tuesday to capitalize on the killing of Hamas's leader by securing the release of the October 7th attack hostages and ending the war in Gaza. Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner reports.
During his talks with Netanyahu on Tuesday, Blinken spelled out U.S. hopes that the death of Yahya Sinwar, Hamas's leader, will provide a new opportunity for peace. But Netanyahu's office has made no mention of any potential ceasefire yet. For its part, Hamas has refused to free scores of hostages seized on October 7th of last year, without an Israeli pledge to end the war and pull out of the territory. Hours ahead of Blinken's visit, air raid sirens sounded in Tel Aviv, signaling incoming rockets from Lebanon. Hezbollah later claimed responsibility for Tuesday's attack, as well as a drone attack on Netanyahu's holiday home on Saturday, adding that there would be no negotiations while fighting continues.
Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner. U.S. State Department spokesman Viden Patel said if North Korea sent troops to Russia, it would mark a dangerous and highly concerning development.
We are, of course, going to continue to consult with our allies and partners on the implications of such a dramatic move. Certainly, if true, it would be another reckless and dangerous action, both on the side of Russia, but of course on the side of the DPRK as well.
South Korea's spy agency said last week that North Korea sent 1,500 Special Operations Forces to Russia this month, and South Korea Tuesday warned it could consider supplying weapons to Ukraine in response to allegations that North Korea dispatched troops to Russia. This is VOA News. The Kremlin said Tuesday that Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese President Xi Jinping discussed Ukraine and other global issues during a meeting on the sidelines of a BRICS summit in the Russian city of Kazan. Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen has more.
Russian President Vladimir Putin called Chinese President Xi Jinping his dear friend as he praised the relationship between their countries and welcomed Xi to Russia for the opening of the BRICS summit. Xi told Putin that chaos reigned internationally, but that Beijing's strategic partnership with Moscow was a force for stability amid the most significant changes seen in a century. In May, the two leaders pledged a new era of partnership between the most powerful rivals of the United States, which they cast as an aggressive nation sowing chaos around the world. A Kremlin spokesperson said Putin and Xi discussed Ukraine, their partnership, and ways to cooperate in the future.
Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen. U.S. intelligence officials warn Russia and Iran may encourage violent protests in the United States after next month's election. According to a newly declassified memo, Russian military intelligence sought to recruit an American to organize protests in the U.S. Iran has also covertly supported protests in the U.S. over the war in Gaza. The memo released on Tuesday says both countries may seek to organize or encourage violent protests as a way of undermining trust in election results and eroding national unity following a contentious campaign. Fears that America's adversaries could seek to fan the flames of polarization have increased since the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Residents in Acapulco, Mexico are struggling to rebuild their lives 1 year after Hurricane Otis killed dozens of people and caused widespread destruction. Reuters correspondent Arthi Thiaprin has more.
Entrepreneur Joaquin Salgado says residents are still struggling.
El impacto, creo que todavía lo seguimos.
We are still living with the impact. We have not overcome it economically or psychologically. It has had quite an impact on us. Acapulco, as everyone knows, was pretty much devastated. Everyone had losses.
According to the Guerrero state government, over 220,000 homes were damaged. Compounding the disaster for the city and Guerrero state was Hurricane John in September. Local media says at least 18 people were killed when the storm hit, many due to landslides that crushed homes.
Reuters correspondent Arthi Thiaprin. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Israel.
We have to make sure that this is a moment of opportunity to move forward.
Charges filed in an alleged assassination plot to kill a critic of the Iranian regime in New York.
Now the FBI announcing me that they found a direct link to the senior member of the Revolutionary Guards, I started to scream.
And former President Jimmy Carter still making history at 100.
He was excited to turn 100, but he's more excited to cast his ballot for Vice President Harris.
Today is Wednesday, October 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition.
I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish.
We start today in Tel Aviv.
That's where U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Israeli leaders on Tuesday, pushing to increase humanitarian access to Palestinians and to end Israel's war in Gaza and Lebanon. Washington is calling for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas and the enforcement of a U.N. resolution that ended the last major war between Israel and Hezbollah. But as White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara reports, both appear elusive.
Israel launched airstrikes targeting the Hezbollah-controlled southern suburb of Beirut and other parts of Lebanon Tuesday, killing tens of people. A day earlier, its troops unleashed an assault on Gaza's Jabalia refugee camp that killed more than a dozen. The attack came days after Israeli troops killed more than 80 people in North Gaza, one of the deadliest attacks in the Israel-Hamas war. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was in Tel Aviv Tuesday, pushing Israel to increase humanitarian access to Gaza and revive ceasefire talks following Israel's killing of Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar last week.
We have to make sure that this is a moment of opportunity to move forward. And that's the focus of all the conversations we're having here.
But Israel appears to be emboldened by its victory in Gaza.
So basically, we are going back to the same groupings within the Israeli society. Some, like Netanyahu, saying, we continue to fight and we release the hostages through more power. Others are saying, we need to get a deal to end the war, to release the hostages, to bring quiet to the other front.
That other front includes Lebanon, where Israel is ramping up operations despite killing Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah last month. Blinken is urging Israel to de-escalate and enforce UN Resolution 1701 that ended its war with Hezbollah in 2006.
So the administration understands that Israel, in a sense, has no choice but to go after the infrastructure of Hezbollah south of the Litani. However, the administration is also somewhat traumatized from the Gaza experience and that the lack of any real alternative mechanism for policing southern Lebanon, for who gets to enforce this the UN resolution. Do we revitalize the UNIFIL force? Do we empower the Lebanese army? Or do we simply allow Israel to kind of engage in this never-ending war?
On the day of Blinken's visit, Israel evacuated the city of Jabalia in northern Gaza in preparation for more strikes. As Israel battles Iran's proxies, Hamas in Gaza, and Hezbollah in Lebanon, it's also weighing direct retaliation against Tehran for its ballistic missile attack earlier this month. From Tel Aviv, Blinken departs for Jordan and other Arab countries. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News, Washington.
Masih Alinejad is a human rights activist and VOA contributor who fled Iran in 2009. She was living in New York City in 2022 when she became the target of a kidnapping and assassination plot. No one knew at the time if Iran was directly involved, but on Tuesday, federal prosecutors announced charges against a senior member of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and three others with links to Iran's government in the plot. Liam Scott spoke with Masih by phone to talk about the latest development in her case.
So just briefly, your reaction to this news today, I don't know if you knew before it was first reported, if you had advance notice, but what's your reaction to this?
I got invited by the FBI this morning. So I had a meeting with the people from Department of Justice and FBI. They announced me that after, you know, like when they arrested the man with AK-47 in front of my house. So I thought that this is the criminal gang from Eastern Europe. Now the FBI announcing me that they found a direct link to the senior member of the Revolutionary Guards. I started to scream in the room. I was so excited because now we have a proof that this is the members, Ali Khamenei's Revolutionary Guards, ordering a man in New York from inside Iran to kill a U.S. citizen.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I was very excited. I started to scream, but at the same time, I started to cry because I was like, oh, this is the same regime killing women in the street, raping women in prison, killing innocent men, executing them. So I wish someone could protect them. That was my reaction, mixed feeling. But at the same time, being sad that the same people cannot be stopped from killing the innocent women and men inside the country.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What does it show that, it, now that we know for sure, that a Revolutionary Guard official was involved in the assassination plot. What does it show about Iran that...
I strongly believe that shows the significance of, like, it shows that assassinating terrorism is in the DNA of the Islamic Republic. So we're talking, because before they hired three men from Eastern Europe, a criminal gang, to actually do their dirty job on U.S. soil. So this is the tactic of the Islamic Republic. Right now, it shows that it is, they cannot get away from punishment, from accountability, because that's why what they do. They, transnational repression became a tool in the hand of Putin, Ali Khamenei, China, Venezuela, to hire criminals, because they know this is how they can get away with it. They can bypass punishment and accountability. But now it shows that this is in the DNA of the Revolutionary Guards. And this is the Islamic Republic directly behind, and the U.S. government must take strong action to stop them, you know. For me, in this situation, when it comes to protect America, national security of America, when it comes to protect the safety of the U.S. citizens, we should all get together, Republican, Democrat. This is not a partisan issue. This is about protecting democracy, because I don't think that they targeted me. I have no fear for my own life. The Iranian regime challenging the U.S. government on U.S. soil, and basically this is targeting the freedom of speech and the national safety of America. So that's why, no matter you are left-wing, right-wing, Republican, or Democrat, when it comes to Islamic terror, I want the U.S. government to be tough and to take a strong action. Because this is the same Revolutionary Guards killing innocent women within the country as well.
Great. Well, Masi, thank you so much. I didn't want to keep you long. Anything else you want to add before you go?
Yeah. I mean, it's a big news, but at the same time, I want to see, to be honest, actions. Like, imagine after this amazing indictment, imagine if any U.S. government go and negotiate with them, or handing out money with them, or accepting the lobbies of the Islamic Republic to normalize this terrorist regime. That will break my heart, because we are talking about terrorism, and terrorism cannot be reformed. The Iranian people want to get rid of the Islamic Republic because we deserve to have secular democracy. Women, life, freedom, revolution is still alive. But this is the moment that the U.S. government and the government across the globe should pick their side to support women like me, or to support our killers. I get more determined to echo the voice of women, life, freedom movement. But is it the same when it comes to the U.S. government or not? That's my question.
That was Liam Scott speaking with Masi Alinejad.
Turning our attention now to the war in Ukraine. We've reported on this show before about Ukrainian accusations of North Korean soldiers helping the Russian forces. The Kremlin has declined to comment on it, and Russia's UN ambassador says the West is scaremongering. Still, though, evidence that North Korean forces are in Russia and preparing to fight in Ukraine is growing. In fact, media reports on Tuesday suggest that North Korean troops could be in southwestern Russia as early as Wednesday. Reuters' Zachary Goldman has more.
If they would be sending troops to Ukraine, that would mark a significant escalation. That would really be important.
Secretary General Mark Rutte was in Estonia for meetings with NATO members and said he didn't yet have confirmation Pyongyang had deployed soldiers to assist Moscow's fight. It's the latest warning that North Korea may soon step directly or indirectly into the conflict on the side of Russia. Here's the UK defense minister speaking in Parliament on Tuesday.
It is now highly likely that the transfer of hundreds of combat troops from North Korea to Russia has begun.
The Kremlin on Monday declined to directly answer a question on whether North Korean troops were going to fight in Ukraine. A Kremlin spokesman said Moscow's cooperation with Pyongyang was not directed against third countries. It's been more than 2 years since Russian forces stormed into Ukraine in what Moscow called a special military operation. But tenacious defenders armed with Western weaponry drove back the initial onslaught, and what appeared intended to be a quick conquest turned into a long and bloody war. Moscow has been forced to supplement its military with new conscripts to sustain the fight. The latest reports suggest it may now be looking beyond its own borders for soldiers. South Korea's spy agency said last week that North Korea had shipped 1,500 special forces troops to Russia's Far East for training at military bases and that they were likely to be deployed for combat in Ukraine. And Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has accused Pyongyang of preparing to send as many as 12,000 soldiers to Russia.
In its failure to overthrow Ukraine's democratically elected government, Russia is seeking to expand the conflict.
The U.S. Deputy Envoy to the United Nations told the Security Council on Monday it had seen reports that North Korean soldiers could soon join the fight.
If true, this marks a dangerous and highly concerning development.
South Korea's Deputy National Security Advisor said on Tuesday that Seoul would consider countermeasures, which could mean directly supplying lethal weapons to Kiev in response to closer military ties between Russia and North Korea.
That's Zachary Goldman of Reuters reporting for us.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. Police in Uganda say at least 11 people, including children, were killed when a fuel truck exploded on Tuesday just outside Kampala. A video shared online by an onlooker appeared to show people scooping up fuel from the truck before the blast.
Poland's foreign minister said he ordered the closure of one of Russia's three consulates in the country in response to acts of sabotage that he said were sponsored by Moscow. Radek Sikorsky demanded that Russia stop its hybrid war activities. He was referring to the case of a Ukrainian man who admitted that he had been hired by Russia for an act of arson.
Musicians from ABBA, Radiohead, and The Cure have joined actors and authors in signing a protest letter against using their works to build artificial intelligence tools. It's the latest public warning about AI tools that can spit out synthetic images, music, and writings after being trained on huge troves of human-made works.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. We'll learn about the process to elect a president in a few minutes.
But now a story about one of our former presidents. After becoming the first U.S. president to reach the age of 100, Jimmy Carter was able to fulfill a wish that he had expressed to his family. VOA's Kane Farabaugh explains.
Plains, Georgia, the hometown of former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, where the streets are lined with signs from the current election supporting both Democrat Kamala Harris and Republican Donald Trump. Democrat Joe Biden won Sumter County and narrowly won the state of Georgia in 2020. Polls show a close race in Georgia, and both campaigns recognize every vote counts, including a prominent one cast by mail-in ballot from the most famous resident of Plains.
He was excited to turn 100, but he's more excited to cast his ballot for Vice President Harris.
Jason Carter, Jimmy Carter's grandson, is chairman of the board of the former president's global nonprofit, Carter Center.
At the end of his 100-year life, and that is continuing on, as we know, to have grown up in the segregated South and for his one of his last political acts to be helping to elect a black woman as a president, I do think it would be important.
President Carter has already said that it was important for him to be able to vote for Barack Obama in 2008.
Joe Crespino is a professor of history at Emory University. He believes Carter's vote is connected to his legacy, specifically his efforts to get the Equal Rights Amendment prohibiting sex discrimination ratified in the U.S. Senate while president.
But voting for the first female candidate of color would be important for him, not only because of his experiences with race over the course of his life, but also his experiences in trying to advance the interests of women in public life.
He wants to see this country brought back together. I think he wants to reduce that polarization. I think he wants us to focus on the things that make us Americans first and fundamentally, and I think that he thinks she can do that.
And I must have 1,100 different Carter buttons.
Philip Curlin says not everyone in Plains agrees with Jimmy Carter or his candidate of choice.
Even though he's firmly come out for Kamala Harris, everyone that's not for her would instantly forgive him and still love him.
As Election Day nears, Jimmy Carter continues to receive hospice care in his modest home on the edge of his hometown, not far from the preserved Depression-era farm where his story began 100 years ago. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Plains, Georgia.
Health officials say six cases of polio were reported in Ivory Coast in 2023 and one so far this year. It doesn't seem like many, but any polio cases are cause for concern among health officials trying to eradicate the disease. VOA's Yasin Siaw reports from Abidjan, narrated for us by Anthony Labruto.
17-year-old Matthew has been paralyzed by CVD PV2 polio since he was 8. His mother says the illness has kept him from attending school and living a normal life. Hortense Bao is Matthew's mother.
I never imagined this would happen to my child. If I had given him the vaccine, he wouldn't be like this. Given his condition, the neighbors say he's cursed. My parents abandoned me and the child.
The disease has ravaged her son's body. Matthew, who chose not to share his last name due to the stigma attached to polio, says his friends have abandoned him and he feels isolated and lonely.
Before, my friends would come and play with me. Now they visit, but they don't come near. I stay home and only play with my brothers.
The World Health Organization describes polio as a highly contagious virus that can cause paralysis, especially in children. In severe cases, it can be fatal. Thankfully, there's only been one case of naturally occurring or wild polio reported in the Ivory Coast since 2011. But the region has reported at least one case this year of CVD-PV2. A serious complication of the oral polio vaccine. The vaccine contains a weakened form of the polio virus. In communities with low immunization rates, that weakened virus can circulate, replicate, and mutate into a form that can cause illness and paralysis, according to the WHO. UNICEF volunteer Emmanuel Ello says that's one reason people resist getting the vaccine.
There are parents who refuse to vaccinate their children. There are some rumors that the polio vaccine contains harmful substances. Sometimes when you visit homes with children, parents claim they don't have children or that their children have already been vaccinated, but that is not true.
In a major step toward eradicating polio globally, the Independent Africa Regional Certification Commission for Polio Eradication declared the WHO Africa region, including the Ivory Coast, free of wild polio virus in 2020. But the threat posed by the CVD-PV2 variant has motivated the Ivorian government and international organizations like UNICEF to intensify vaccination efforts. Abdul Gadiri Fadiga, the country's UNICEF Health and HIV Program Chief, says he has been monitoring cases of CVD-PV2 polio since 2019.
Thanks to epidemiological surveillance, we have detected polio cases in regions like Abidjan, San Pedro, Daloa, Aboiso, and Bouake. This is why our response is focused on these semi-rural areas.
Fadiga says organizations are now leveraging technological innovations to combat the spread of polio.
Previously, we relied on oral vaccines. Now we have injectable options. We also utilize technologies like the Open Data Kit system used by the WHO to track polio cases. With these resources and the commitment of governments like Ivory Coast, I'm confident that in a few years, we'll declare polio defeated, eradicated.
The WHO reported that one vaccine-related polio case in Ivory Coast occurred in April, highlighting the urgent need for vaccination efforts to combat polio's resurgence. For Yasin Siaw in Abidjan, Ivory Coast, Anthony Labruto, VOA News.
It's often believed that in the United States, we vote for the president. That's sort of true. We vote for electors who in turn vote for the president. Why do we do it this way? It's a compromise that goes back to the country's founding. Brian Kalt is a professor at Michigan State University's College of Law. He explains.
So the Electoral College was created because when the United States was formed in the 1780s, it was made of independent states. Instead of having one big national vote for president, there would be a series of votes in each state. And each state would cast a certain number of votes for president, and that would be by population. So it would roughly approximate what a national vote would look like, but it would keep the power in the individual states. to choose the president.
Now, roughly approximate, I think that's the important part there. It is possible. In fact, we've seen it pretty recently for somebody to win the popular vote, to get more citizens voting for them, but yet not become president because they didn't get enough electoral votes. How does that work?
In a country that has a parliamentary system, there might be one party has the most seats in parliament, and so they their leader becomes the prime minister. But each district has its own independent vote. So if you added up all of the individual votes for one party or another, maybe one party would have more votes, but the other party would have won more seats. The other there is one other reason that there is that disparity potentially, though, and that is I said before that each state gets a number of votes proportional to their population, but it's based on the number of representatives that the state has in the House of Representatives, which is purely a matter of population, plus the number of senators. And every state has two senators. So the smallest states, if this was proportional, the smallest states would only have one vote. But the system is set up so that the smallest ones get three instead of one. And so small states have a disproportionate power in the Electoral College.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that makes it so that some votes are kind of worth more than others, no?
Yes, there are a couple of ways in which that happens. One is small states have disproportionate weight. They get more bang for their buck. But another issue is that most states, 48 of the 50 states, will allocate their votes completely to the winner. So if you win a state by one popular vote, you get all of the electoral votes for that state. And so what happens is you could have a state where someone wins by millions and millions of votes. That doesn't do them any more good than if they won that state by one vote.
Do you think democracy would function better now, given the changes since the Constitution was written? Would it function better if the Electoral College was gone and it was simply one person, one vote?
There are advantages and disadvantages to it. I think it's going to continue to be, particularly in the wake of elections like in 2016, where the winner of the popular vote lost in the Electoral College, that doesn't sit well with people. There is nothing in a parliamentary system, there's nothing preventing one side from getting the votes of more people, but the other side winning more seats and getting control of who's prime minister. That's just a vestige of this so-called first-past-the-post voting system, where if you win by one vote, you win the seat. If you win by a million votes, you win the seat. That's why we have the disparity between the electoral votes you get and the total popular votes. And you don't have to amend the Constitution to fix that. If states wanted to, states could say, instead of giving our electoral votes to the candidate who wins the most votes in our state, we choose to give our electoral votes to the candidate who wins the national popular vote. And they could do that. And there's actually a movement afoot called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, where if they get enough states to agree to do that, then without amending the Constitution, we would have the popular vote decide who's president. The states that have signed up for this said, our agreement to do this takes effect once enough states have agreed to this, that the winner would be guaranteed, and then we would switch over to this popular vote system. So that's sort of in the air, and depending on how things go, I could imagine that picking up some steam and maybe becoming, you know, in 4, 8, 12, 16 years, that might be the way we choose to elect our presidents.
Brian Kalt is a professor at Michigan State University's College of Law. Professor Kalt, thanks so much for your time today. Thanks for the lesson.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that'll do it for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for listening. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.